where the pain is coming from.
Man.
Oh, sorry.
Oh. Ooh, ha, ho.
Welcome to the Carl Landry Record Club. I was just telling Moo, a music podcast from the rights Ricky Sanchez, I hurt my back putting on socks yesterday. Like, so part of the battle, I had hip replacement surgery. Part of the, like, the my measuring whether I'm back or not is whether I can put a sock on my right foot, which I wasn't able to do for months prior to the surgery, but also the months after the surgery. And I can get to it, but it's like a challenge right now. And I'm probably better not doing, like, I'm probably better using, like, the thing that I have that can help me get my sock on without doing it. And I did it last night, and
it kind of got you a little bit.
Yeah, like, it got my back, but I'm feeling the soreness is actually coming from right around where the wound is, the on the hip. That's like, that's where it's radiating from.
Well, trial and error, man. You don't know until you try, you know?
Yeah. Well, I know now.
Now you know. Now you know.
I tried and I erred. I was actually talking to the physical, we'll get right past this, I promise. But I was talking to the physical therapist when I was there this past week. And the thing that I hadn't thought of is that they actually, like, cut through everything in that area to get to the hip or whatever. So if you just imagine that, like, your skin and your muscle and your stuff was torn there, and right, that was the only thing that happened, you would imagine that would be months before that area would be, you know, fine. You don't even think about that, like, because you're thinking about the joint and all that kind of stuff, but that spot has to heal as well.
And so, it's like, you know, any situation, recovery is never linear. So,
it's
two
sure
steps
as
forward,
fuck
one
is
step
not
back kind of thing.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, for sure. So, welcome.
What a start to the pod.
Welcome,
yeah, baby.
Welcome. Yeah. We talk about two albums and usually a single every time on the pod. We are a music appreciation podcast with a special affinity for albums. We always pick an album 1 week and you pick an album. You can do one by going to our website, carlandryrecordclub.com, doing it in the Spotify box right under the player where it asks you for that specific question, doing the Apple podcast reviews, going to our social accounts. There's a million different ways to do so. The two albums today, it is my week, so I got to pick an album, and the album I picked is Wild Pink's Yoke in the Fur, which came out in 2018, which is amazing that we hadn't done, because you and I have spoke about that album, I feel like, a bunch privately, and we had John Ross from Wild Pink on, but I think to talk about A Billion Little Lights.
Right, we had him on right as they were getting ready to release A Billion Little Lights. As a matter of fact, I think they were two singles in, if I recall.
Yes.
So yeah. I actually ended up spending more time with that record just because I sort of had more of a personal connection with it from our interview with John. But I remember you had first introduced me to that band, sent me this record, but I hadn't spent as much time with it, so it was kind of good to go back to it.
For sure. The listener album comes from Dylan. It is Southern River Band's Rumor and Innuendo, which came out in 2019. Dylan says, I recently discovered the Southern River Band and haven't stopped listening to their album Rumor and Innuendo since. The new single, Stan Quaylen, is also awesome. I didn't listen to that. And then speaking of new singles, Moot got to pick a new song, which is the song Brambles from Frank Carter and the Rattlesnakes. Every time I look at that band name, I want to say Fred Carter and the Rattlesnakes. Fred Carter, of course, former Sixers, short-term former Sixers head coach, Fred Carter.
Wait, that's you know, I'm a lifelong fan. What era was he? I missed that.
Fred Carter was post-Charles, was right in the middle. Let's see when
post-Charles.
Fred Carter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, my guess is Fred Carter is a Clarence Weatherspoon era.
I remember Clarence Weatherspoon.
Hold on. Let me see. Fred Carter coached the Sixers. I want to get it right. This is his playing career. I got to look at his coaching career. Where's his coaching career? Now I need to see it. Fred Carter coaching. There we go. Fred Carter's coaching record. Fred Carter coached the Sixers. Wow, way longer than I thought. Oh, no, that's assistant coach. He was head coach 92, 93, and 93, 94.
During that phase, yeah. Post-Charles, pre-Allen Iverson.
Yes, he had a record of 7-19 in his first season, and then a record of 25-57 in his second season.
That sounds about right for, that's sort of the median for
post-superstar?
A Sixers coach.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, for sure. Win 30% of your games.
I mean, you know, there's some, you know, there's some above the median, some below. That seems right about in the right zone right there.
Yeah. Let's start with Wild Pink. We'll start with Wild Pink.
Cool.
Yoke in the Fur.
Bending the road and bloody asphalt saw, and I wonder how different some days go.
Wild Pink, do you know, it's funny, I've liked this band for a long time, and we did have John Ross on, though I had never done a deep dive on like where they came from or what they did, and when, or you know, their origins, and actually, there's not really a lot there. So this conversation will be more about the album than the, I guess, sort of like the history of Wild Pink. Maybe we get John Ross on, and we document it, and then update their Wikipedia, I think would be.
It would be good to get him when he was like very early on. He was our... third interview and fifth or sixth episode or something.
It was in 2020, so that was right as we started. So Wild Pink is from New York, and I think when John Ross was on, he said he was from Queens, and he is a Mets fan, which tracks. I've seen him wear Mets hats repeatedly. So they've been around recording-wise for almost 10 years. They are John Ross, who we mentioned, Arden Yonkers on bass, which is a great name if you are from New York,
name. That is a great name. Yeah,
Dan Keegan drums and Mike Brenner, who plays the steel guitar. They are now, when their first EP came out, which is called Two Songs and came out in 2015, they were listed as a completely different lineup. So it was John Ross, T.C. Brownwell, and John Frank, who also, by the way, pre-Wild Pink, released music under the band name Challenger. So after the Two Songs EP, they got signed to Tiny Engines, a independent label, which they are still on, to the best of my knowledge. I think their records still come out on Tiny Engines. And they released another EP in 2016 called Good Life, and then their self-titled full-length debut in 2017. Since then, and then Yoke in the Fur came out in 2018. Since then, they released A Billion Little Lights in 2020, and then I Love You So Much in 2022, which is a great record. And it's amazing. I had no idea any of this part happened during, like, previous to I Love You So Much. John Ross was diagnosed with cancer.
Oh,
and and had several surgeries to
to hear that, man. That happened just in the last couple of years, I guess.
It was 2022 is when is when all the interviews were out about it. So I think it was previous to that. He is good to go and he is fine. He's beaten it, but it sort of informed the album I Love You So Much. When you go back and you listen to it and listen to some of the songs, I think knowing what he was going through is pretty interesting. And he co-produced that record with the guy from the Antlers who wrote that album Hospice, did.
Oh man, that was a heavy, heavy album. Wow.
Like maybe the heaviest album we've ever done. And
conceptually, I can't think of anything else that's that, you know, intense or that documents something of that nature. You don't normally, you might see people touch on it on a song or two, but not for like an entire concept album around it.
If you want to write an album about your experience with cancer, getting the guy from the Antlers might not be a bad person to help you.
I mean, it sounds strange to say, but actually he knows how to, he's done that kind of record. So
he can certainly talk about grief. And it's funny because I never like got that when I listened to that record, which I like better than A Billion Little Lights, actually. I like Yoke in the Fur better than all three of them, but at the most of the three of them. But going back and listening to it, I think is interesting knowing what he went through. Yoke in the Fur, I think I can say now, is one of my favorite albums of like of all time. I remember hearing about Wild Pink, listening to a music podcast with Steve Hyden and Ian, what's his last name?
Ian Cohen.
And they were doing a podcast about their favorite music of the year so far or something. And at that time, I was just like, I was looking for recommendations that were not, you know, algorithmic or whatever. So I just listened to their pod and listened to the bands they talk about and then just go listen to a song and see if I liked it or not. And they were talking about Wild Pink. And this album hit me just sort of like immediately. I was reading an interview with Ian Cohen with John Ross about the album at the time. And he said, I think this record is more in line with what I really love, like Tom Petty, Jackson Browne, Bruce Springsteen. It's amazing how much he loves Springsteen and mentions Springsteen, and I do not hear Springsteen in it, but
in a more general sense. Well, Tom Petty I hear more, but more of the 100%. Roots rock Americana influence definitely there.
Absolutely. And he said, I always wanted to do music like that, like classic rock, but I never thought I could. The first album unlocked something, that there's more to this whole world than I'm letting myself explore. And I do hear Tom Petty, I think, certainly like mid-career Tom Petty, not early Heartbreakers, but just that, like mid to late 80s, early 90s Tom Petty. Tonally, I hear it a lot. I think one of the most amazing things about this album to me is how it can sound so sort of like lush and beautiful, but not at all overproduced at all.
It's a pretty remarkable. Yeah, that's a hard thing to pull off, but I think because there's still a sense of space within the production. There's not like, it never feels over inundated with sound. It just feels vast, I think.
Yes.
That's a tough balance to find, but they find it.
Yeah. And it sounds like I don't know if it is, but it certainly sounds like an analog recording to me. And it's sort of like one of these things where it sounds well-produced and lush, but also sounds like it could have been, there are some strings in there that I wouldn't guess were recorded live, but by and large, sound like it could have been recorded live. And I think underrated things about the album, at least from my perspective, that when I was going back and listening to it for this, is how good the guitar playing is in general.
Yes.
And how good, like I assume it's John Ross, sounds like he's finger picking, and how like precise and beautiful and like in the pocket all of the guitar playing is.
There's so much melody in his playing.
Yeah.
That sometimes it's more upfront, other times it's buried a little more in the track, and it's almost like you feel it more than you hear it. But yep. It's a pretty steady thread. That was one thing that I really did notice, maybe more than I'd picked up on their other records, but just, yeah, the guitar playing is just exceptional.
And the album does a really nice thing, not every song into every song, but sort of like one song sort of fading into the next one.
I love that. And I love that, the way, because it pulls you in. You almost get into a trance with it, especially if you have it on the headphones. I mean, you just lose yourself.
Especially when you're listening to the entire album, and it sort of like encourages you to listen to the album in a row rather than shuffling the album. I think the album listens better that way. And it actually even starts from the first song. Like the Burger Hill eases you into the album almost. Like it's almost as if the first song is tailing off of a different song. Like it comes down from here and sort of drifts you into the record. And even the guitar playing in the beginning of this song, at the beginning of Burger Hill, I think is beautiful. And then he doesn't do it in every, they don't do it in every song, but he's an excellent hook writer. And I think that the hook in this song is like gets in your head. And I think the lyric writing and the hook in the opening song are great. Like there are a couple of lyrical things that I picked out. When our time's up, we'll carry on like smoke after the fire's gone is a like is a beautiful lyric. And I think I woke up too fast from a dream and I'm running with me. Outside the moonlight catches the ice like clay, it tricks the eyes. He's a great lyric writer.
Throughout
it's a great
the record, there
track.
Are moments like that where certain mm-hmm. phrases hit you and you almost want to go back just to really, delve into it.
For sure. I think, so we talk about one going into another and the guitar playing. And I don't think that there's a better example of this than Civility at Gunpoint into Jules Drost in The Runoff.
I've got that right here.
Yeah, like, so Civility at Gunpoint is a less than a minute sort of guitar interlude that almost sets the scene for what I think is the best song in the album, Jules Drost and The Runoff, and certainly like the biggest song in the album. And it actually reminds me, I don't know if you remember of this. This is a crazy thing to bring up in the context of this record, but in the beginning of Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is a great Warrant song from the album Cherry Pie.
We did that record, didn't we? Yeah.
We did. Yeah. We did. Yeah. And there's this awesome like acoustic intro to that song that the song just would not be as good without that acoustic intro. And Civility at Gunpoint is an amazingly played guitar interlude track that sort of that leads you into Jules Drost and The Runoff.
Yeah, that whole sequence there coming out of Yoke and the Fur into that one, into Jules Drost and The Runoff, that's just it's right about midway through, or I guess it's track 3 through 5.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like it's the perfect peak of the album. And then just the whole, at every step, it kind of takes you on a different journey, different songs. It kind of keeps you in the same, it's interesting. It stays in a certain musical space, but then within that, it feels very dynamic. It doesn't feel, you know, they lock into a certain ambiance or a certain mood, but within that mood, there's a lot of variation.
For sure. And Jules Drost and The Runoff, I think, is, we were just talking about hooks. The song doesn't really have one, I don't think. I think there are moments of the song that get into your head, but whereas Burger Hill starts off so slowly, if you start at the beginning of the track of this song, like where it comes in, it is a beautiful sort of like soundscapey, almost, and it reminds me of Petty maybe more than any other moment on the album, in that you could imagine the visual of the beginning of this song to be like wheat fields almost, like under
it gives you
sun.
Those kind of, it evokes those kind of images for sure.
For sure, yeah. And it does an amazing job of coming in so big and so beautiful and then sort of drops away and creates that space for him to sing during the verses and then comes right back for whatever, like, I guess what the chorus is. But like, I do think it's neat to have the bigness without his voice without the bigness, and then they both come together at the end of that first verse, which is an amazing, I think, moment, you know?
I think that's one of my favorite dynamics, like what you keyed in on there is how it can sound so vast, but then when his vocals come in, it always feels very upfront and intimate. And that's a thread I've seen through all their records, is that that's just, there's a certain magic in the production to be able to do that, where the production sounds 3D. Like we talked about, it sounds very vast.
Yeah.
But then as soon as his vocals come in, it feels like it's right up there on the mic, you know? And you can almost strip all that other stuff away. It would be this very intimate folk sounding kind of record. But the hybrid of those two things is just, the way they do it is, it's singular. I think it actually sets them aside, because I've heard other bands do something similar, but not quite in the way that Wild Pink does it. I think it's probably a testament to John Ross's production vision, because I know, remember we talked to him, he talked about how much time he spends really delving into what he wants to do production-wise. He knows what he wants to get, and he seems to be very meticulous in the way he goes about it.
His vocals sound like he is, his mouth is right on your shoulder, and he is whispering it into your ear.
He's never over-singing. He's never belting it out. It's just right there, Yeah.
It's on the forefront without him being big. You know, the vocals are present without him being big. And again, like great lyric writing. Like, I want to do what you do. I want to be what you are. You're the sweetest one to have lost so much is, another well-written lyric.
And that's the thing. We talk about the lyrics. You could strip a lot of this production away and hear him play these songs acoustically, especially because I know there are long musical sections, but a lot of those are driven by the guitar. So it'd be interesting to strip it all away, hear what he does vocally in the songs, but then so much of the musicality is actually contained in the guitar. So a lot of the stuff would work very well just solo stripped away. But once you add those additional textures, then it just kind of, it spreads it out even more.
Yeah, I've seen them twice. I saw them in Philly at a very, very tiny place. I mean, honestly, the place seemed like a room that did not seem like a concert venue. It seemed like the stock room at a store or something. It was the smallest place I've ever seen. And then I'm pretty sure I saw them at the Bowery Ballroom in New York, but they sounded great both times. And it's not quite as soft. The songs are not quite as soft live as they are on record. Like there's almost like a tone on the record that is like the audio version of Portrait Mode on a phone. Almost like there's a softness to all of it that doesn't quite translate. I don't think quite as well, that part of it quite as well live, but the songs all sound great live.
And I know, I think we mentioned this when John came on, but Mike Brenner, Slow-Mo, is part of this band. Philly legendary musician.
Right.
And it's cool that there is kind of the Philly connection there. He had a band called Slow-Mo featuring Mike Recco, which is kind of his sound with the lap steel, but with the hip hop element mixed in. He had an MC that was a really cool project. But he's a guy who's just shows up in so many different places, and studio wise and live and in the band. It's really cool that I'm sure he adds a great element live, because he's one of those people that wherever he shows up, there's some extra musical mojo that happens.
And the last song I wanted to point out is Love Is Better. To the Kim Carnes song on the radio.
Not to his friend, he just quietly gifted a new smartphone. Through the open windows in the bar, we feel the summer's here.
Which is a great sort of like, might be like the song with the most pace or like momentum on the entire record. And I think when you listen to that song, it is a better indication of their music to come than any other song on this album. Like, it reminds me more of A Billion Little Lights and I Love You So Much than anything else on this album. And again, like lyrically, through the open windows in the bar, we feel the summer's heat and all we want, and we all want another chance and a little understanding. Love is better than anything else is a...
This is one of those records where I think what happens is initially you're absorbed by the music.
Yes.
And you're taken in. So you got to kind of live with it. Mm-hmm. And then you go to the lyrics from there. And that's actually what puts it over the top. Because once you start to hear what's happening lyrically with some of these things, then it puts it over the top for you. I think that the best records do that. They'll pull you in with the hooks, the melody, the composition, the arrangements. But if you really live with it, what'll keep you maybe coming back more frequently than other albums is what happens lyrically.
Yeah,
because you'll always look for that certain line or something that pops out in a new way for you.
And that exact process has happened to me with this album. How did this album like ring to you, knowing the other ones better first than this one?
Yeah, I really like this one. I think maybe taking it all in, it might be my favorite as well. I spent the most time with A Billion Little Lights, just because we had sort of a personal connection to that one. But I think the one other band that I can think that does this, but in their own very distinct way, is War on Drugs, where it's a roots Americana thing at its core. You know, you hear that influence, but then it's these soundscapes.
Yeah.
And they're two, they have that similar dynamic, but in two very different ways. But I think that's just a very appealing style of music. I don't know what you would call it. That's indie roots rock, or I don't know. How do you personify it?
I think so. A bunch of guys that grew up loving Bruce Springsteen and somehow ended up making music like this. Like, it is all, even you can even hear it in the second Killers record. Like, you can hear it in Sam's Town. Like, there's no doubt to me that this sort of that sonically there's a lot of similarities between that and this.
And with them, I'd say it's almost, you hear more of like a U2.
Yes.
Arena rock kind of thing with Wild Pink and War on Drugs. Well, I would say War on Drugs also goes more into that direction, where you can feel there's a grandiose feeling to it, where you can hear it in an arena. With Wild Pink, it's a little more intimate, because I think partially because of how John's voice just sits right up front in the mix there.
Yeah.
But it's a really beautiful combination. And one other tune that stood out to me was The Seance on St. Augustine Street.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful tune. That one, it's a, kind of was mentioned before, still within a similar atmospheric space as some of the other tunes, but kind of makes a pivot. Almost has a bluesier feel to it, and almost you hear a little bit of the 90s alt-rock thing, which I know he's a fan of that music. He's a big Kurt Cobain fan. And the lyrics on that one, I mean, there's so many good lyrics, but that lyric really stuck with me. Speaks on a sense of alienation, isolation. He says, the clock is ticking and I'm on my feet. I've got a feeling that I'm still asleep. I don't know if I'm on track or so far away. Look around to the faces that used to pull me through, and they can't help me now. And then he locks in on that line, and they can't help me now. Just kind of riffs on that. That's just I think that's about maybe 2/3 of the way through. But I think more than any band I can think of that we've discussed, I really do feel you have to absorb this music as a whole.
Yeah, I think so too. I think... And it is interesting to think about him as being influenced by Cobain and this music, which is not immediately reminiscent of Nirvana specifically, but I think the way that he writes the lyrics, and you have, the more you listen to it, you can hear that influence in the music for
sure.
And
occasionally, yeah, like especially, not often, but like on this one, there are certain chord moves that happen mm-hmm. that suddenly made me think of the 90s, early 90s alt rock, but the A-list, you know, Nirvana and some of those bands that had a very, you know, the one thing about those bands, and I know they're kind of all over the place, but whether it's Soundgarden or Pearl Jam or something, but one thread through all of them is the level of songwriting.
Yeah.
That, to me, you know, it was kind of a marketing gimmick, the way they put all those bands together. But if you had to look at one cornerstone element of all of them, is the songwriting. At the end of the day, that's what puts it over the top. That's what this record does, because, you know, there's a soundscape element, which is just, you can kind of lose yourself in that. But when you break down the songs, they're very well constructed, very well written songs. And like you said, there are actually a good number of catchy hooks. Mm-hmm. You don't always, with this kind of record, you wouldn't always think of that. You would think it's more about the mood and the atmosphere. But these are actually very well written songs with some big melodies in them.
This album stuck in my head, like different parts of this album stuck in my head maybe longer and more frequently than most records I've listened to over the last 5 or 6 years. You know, after I fell in love with it, there were just like, it doesn't feel earwormy when you're listening to it, but it happens, you know, the more you listen to the album.
It's like the hooks kind of sneak up on you.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not necessarily expecting them mm-hmm. because of the production style, it almost puts you in a different mindset where you're not even worried about that. But then when the hooks come in, it's you almost don't expect it. And the next thing you know, there were a couple different hooks on this tune that I kept hearing in my head after I listened through a few times. So, but he does that, I think. There's a number of tunes on A Billion Little Lights that are like that too.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, there's maybe even bigger melodies on that one. But I would agree with you, this is a better overall album, I think. I preferred it maybe, but pretty much everything. I mean, they've been consistent in what they do.
The great band that has really, I think, is critically appreciated and has a nice fan base and tours and has like slowly but surely grown over the last 5 years in terms of their their fan base, but I would have thought would have hit like more of a critical mass by this point than they have. Like they definitely have a good fan base and they tore good rooms, but I thought that there would be a moment. Our friends the War on Drugs should take these guys out.
I don't know. That would be, I was just thinking that would be a phenomenal bill. War on Drugs and Wild Pink. I mean,
this is my message to the folks in War on Drugs.
It would be such a good fit. And like I said, because they generally mine some similar territory, but they're so different within the way they do it.
Absolutely.
Adam's songwriting approach is very different than John's. And even sonically, some things they do are different. I mean, there's a lot of differences there, but
it'd be like Pearl Jam having gone on tour with Nirvana. Like that's the same.
Yeah.
Same genre, coming at it from a same time, same space, different attacks of it. Like, come on, like let's make this happen.
That would be an amazing tour.
It would be a great tour. I would actually get off my ass. I would still whine that day that it was too late and I didn't feel like staying out, but I would definitely go.
I would definitely be there. I would be there to see that in multiple cities if I could.
Yeah, for sure. Well, multiple cities. I don't know.
Well, you
I don't
know
about that.
Yeah. If it's a weekend, it's a weekend.
Yeah.
You can do it on a weekend. Right. You can do it on a weekend.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Why don't we do Southern River Band next? Southern River Band, the name of the album being Rumor and Innuendo.
Were you familiar with this band?
No, it is awesome.
Amazing. I wasn't familiar with them at all. Yet another in now what's become a very, very long line of Australian bands.
They're Australian?
Yes.
Ah, that's so funny. I would have not guessed it in a trillion years that they're...
I mean, what's going on down there? There's something in the water, I got to say.
Yeah,
there's something there in the water down there.
Yeah.
What percentage of bands that we've discussed have been from Australia? It's got
to
be.
Feels like it has to be like 15 or 20%,
easily.
Which is an outrageous percentage when you think of the size of that country and the amount of music that we've done.
And is that perhaps a reflection of the fact that I know we have some great listeners in Australia, as does the Ricky has a big fan base down there.
Yeah, I think it has to be. I think it is the Ricky connection and then the fact that I have favorite. Like that I'm a silver chair guy.
Right.
So like, I think that may have brought people into the pod.
Gang of Youths. I mean,
Gang of Youths as well.
One of our best interviews was, with David.
Yeah. I think that is it. I can't believe this band is Australian. It is amazing.
Man.
Yeah.
And yeah, this record is just awesome. I mean.
Oh, it's so good.
Much fun. So give a brief backdrop on them. They have been around that long, not even a decade. Formed in 2015 in Thornleigh, Australia. The band is Callum Kramer on guitar and vocals, Anton Dindar on bass, Jason Canigli on guitar, and Carlo Romeo on drums. Four-piece band. Now, they were one of these bands, I know you've encountered this sometimes too, where sometimes you can't readily find a lot of information immediately.
Yeah, I would have bet that an Australian, like, southern hair band or whatever, that you wouldn't have found a lot. There isn't a lot there.
It was a bit of a search, but actually the best resource I found was a radio station website. There is a radio station, which I imagine played a pretty big role in helping to establish them, 92.1 RTR FM in Perth.
Okay.
So there are two different pages I found that are associated with this website profile. So I'm going to go through the first one. There's a bit of a question and answer with these guys, which once you hear some of their answers, makes a lot of sense because there's a spirit in the music that you then hear in the way they present themselves. So first question comes in, describe your sound. They say, rock and roll with a dash of boogie woogie and a sprinkle of country.
There you go. Okay.
And then now, so some of the things I read, like this thing I read, I'm like, is this real? Is this sort of tongue in cheek made up? Formation. It says, we all met in different places. To name a few, the Sebastian Bach concert in 2009, a car wash out in Kalamunda, Pinky Beach on Rottnest. However, it was the old Thornley Tavern that brought us all together. So it was a bar. I guess that makes sense. The Sebastian Bach concert. I mean, I guess.
Yes.
Yes. That makes perfect sense. I guess.
Yeah. As soon as I heard it, it brought me back to like 1989. I know there's a lot of Southern rock in here, but there were hair bands from that era that were Southern rock influenced. Tesla, one of them, and then Dangerous Toys, a band that we never talked about, certainly had that same feel. Even there were points at even in Guns N' Roses, I think, where you hear it. So the fact that they met at a Sebastian Bach concert honestly lines up perfectly.
Makes perfect sense. So then they asked them their influences. Lynyrd Skynyrd, AC/DC, Van Halen, The Stones, anything that doesn't suck, really. That's the answer that comes here. So as you research this band, there's a little bit of an element of mystery and also something tongue-in-cheek. So there's a second sort of profile I saw there that was a preview for them doing an on-air at the station. And here they gave the full bio. So I'm just going to read this bio just to really get a perspective on how these guys like to present themselves. So it starts, in a world where starting off a biography with quote-unquote in a world where is the norm, the Southern River Band are apparently no different. In the very same world where labeling oneself is encouraged, where being able to describe one's style is expected, the Southern River Band neither know nor care how to fit themselves into these pigeonholes. Head south on Perth's so-called freeway, jump on Roe Highway, hang a right on Nicholson Road, go through the busiest roundabout in Australia, and you'll find yourself in Thornley, the home of the Southern River Band. A country town in the heart of the suburbs where the jukeboxes stock very little other than the very same songs you would have heard reverberating out of them in the 1970s. They say you're a product of your surroundings. Who are they? Nobody knows. But they're not far from wrong. You're bound to find one of the boys recycling their spare change, putting on Come Back Again for the third time in the space of 4 hours on any given Friday. I read this bio and I was like, okay, I get what these guys are. There's a retro nostalgia thing, but it's not taking itself seriously. The music is serious, but they have a sense of humor about themselves. I think you hear that as you listen to the record.
100%. Man, this is like, it got me 5 seconds in.
Yeah.
5 seconds in. I was like, all right, I'm in.
Out of the gate. And listening to this album, this makes perfect sense. They're well known for their live performances. I mean, they are.
Oh, I'm sure.
From all accounts, they're a dynamite live band. And that's really how they've established themselves. They've been releasing singles going back to, I guess, about 2018, although they actually, their debut was a record called Live at the Pleasure Dome in 2016. They released a number of singles. This one, this record that we're discussing, came out in 2019. This one is Rumor and Innuendo. And then they put out one more record since then, live from Rada Studios, and I think they have another single. So they put out a good amount of music, but by all accounts, they're a band you should see live. And the other thing to mention is they're just now breaking out internationally. I mean, they've become popular in Australia, but okay, they're just now this spring doing their first ever international tour through the EU and UK. So I'm not even sure if they've made it to the States yet. But a band like this, it's they could break at any time because this is a sound that I think a lot of people love. I mean, it's just recognizable in the best way.
My guess is the lead guitar player plays a Strat and plays on the bridge pickup. And it's one of those Strats that has a humbucker in the bridge.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, like that. That would be my guess. I feel like I can see it, man.
You hear this band and you can visualize them, right?
100%. Yes. Yeah.
I love something that is familiar, but this is a new band that does it in a fresh way.
You've never heard this. They remind me so much of Dangerous Toys, which was like a late 80s, early 90s hair band. Let me play like 5 seconds of it. But the same sort of like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's got that high, like falsetto kind of voice.
Yeah.
But even his natural voice, it's high.
Yep. Great to hear the hook. They also had a song called Sportin' a Woody.
Oh, wow. Yeah. What was the band again? What was the group again?
Dangerous Toys. They're fucking great.
Are they still around? Or are they still a band?
I don't think so. I think they probably had I remember two albums. I think the singer was a guy named Jason McMaster, and they were one of those bands that was on MTV during the hair band era, but it was like they never got particularly popular or anything, but they were a fun band.
You got me thinking about that documentary we did, the special episode where we
Decline of Western Civilization.
Yes.
Too.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that, that's the, those bands are exactly in that wheelhouse.
For sure.
In that, yeah, that era, yeah, that sound.
If the guys in Southern River Band have not watched Decline of Western Civilization 2, The Metal Years, they should certainly
absolutely
watch it.
I would think they have.
They have
must
to
have.
On the tour bus at some point?
Come
like,
on. That's,
yeah.
I'm 90% sure they have.
Yeah.
So going through some of the highlights here, I mean, talk about, you mentioned it, starting a record, Chimney.
Yeah.
Lead track. Right out of the gate, you're like, yes, this. You know what this is, and you can hear it's very well done. Just that monster riff just perfectly sets the tone for the whole record. We talked about this with a number of other bands. When you brought in Cinderella, for example.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Another hair band influenced by Southern rock, by the way, for
absolutely,
sure.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. But what I like about Cinderella and some of the other bands that we've discussed, I think you could say Warrant has the same thing, is I like when I can hear the blues in it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's there. It's not... It's, you don't have to look too far to like hear the blues riffs, to hear that sensibility. And that's what I love about this band, because you hear that there's an underpinning in a lot of these songs, including this one that has that. This song in particular, classic. Well, it could be Southern rock, but I would say more hair band breakdown. The AB section between the vocal section and the riff.
Yeah.
That's such a good formula for a song.
And by the way, the riff for this song is almost certainly the hook.
It is actually. Like, it's the more memorable thing. Not that the vocal hook isn't good, but
yeah.
But actually, the guitar is the hook. Actually,
is the hook, because I almost think that you would say that sort of like call and like there was this call and response thing between the lead singer and like the gang vocals or whatever. But that almost feels like the bridge to me. It does not feel like the hook. And then like immediately after that is that riff by itself, which I think is the hook of the song.
Absolutely. And you mentioned that dynamic of the call and response between the lead singer and the band. First off, I have to say, Callum Kramer, a great lead singer. I mean, for this style of music, he's the
100%.
But the dynamic of the back and forth between him and the band just made me think of Def Leppard.
Right? Yeah.
Kind of. I mean, I guess you wouldn't really consider Def Leppard 80s, would you? Because they really started in the 70s. But
no, they rode that wave. I mean, they started in the 70s, like in the sort of like influenced by Bowie, British Invasion sort of thing. But after High and Dry, like I would say like Pyromania and then Hysteria. And then what's the album that came after it? That was all hairband. That was all 80s hairband stuff. I mean, they started before that, but like they certainly rode that wave and were part of that era.
Yeah, sure. And I love that dynamic of the call and response with the group and the lead singer.
Yeah.
Another highlight, Do You Miss Me? The motion of travel, the distance on my fears from its mouth to its ear. That has a more of a vintage 70s sound to me, more of the Southern rock sound.
So, you know what it reminded me of? I don't know if you hear this, is like, there's something about it that had like a Replacements or a Big Star vibe to it. Like, I don't.
Absolutely.
You do what I mean? Like, yes. And it's not something that you would think. Now, Replacements, certainly like a great pop sensibility, and same with Big Star too, but it's not really something that you would think, given everything that we've said leading up to this point.
It's a departure from everything we've been discussing, yeah.
But there was something about it to me that felt like that. Maybe it was in the songwriting, or maybe it was in the tone of the guitars or something, but there was something that reminded me of those bands.
I also think on that one, you see the range that they have, because it's not just top to bottom hair metal, retro send up kind of thing. It's they have more to them than that. That's where the country, they say, Boogie Woogie and a little bit of country. I don't know if that's, yep, you know, sort of 70s country rock. And one other tune I'll highlight is When It All Falls Apart. had a, I mean, when I hear that song, I think there are few bands that I've heard that can do the 70s, 80s big riff thing like this band.
Yeah.
They have mastered it. They know exactly what it is. And it's not just that it's, see, I love a band that, you know, they're unabashedly retro, but it doesn't just feel like a genre exercise to me. There's more to it. There's a real musical personality within this.
And it sounds like they love the music, which is why they are doing it.
Right.
Which is, as opposed to, there are some band, I'm not like, it's certainly not an accusation, but there are some bands that are so reminiscent of other bands and it feels like they're ripping them off, but there's something about this that does not feel that way to me when I listen. It feels like a, we heard this and we love this music, as opposed to we are ripping this music off.
Yeah, I think it's in the category of it pays homage to and then builds on. It's not just a almost a send-up of or a parody of or something. It's just, it has those influences that you recognize as a touchstone, but they are distinctive in and of themselves. And that actually comes down to the writing still and the level of performance they bring. And like you said, you listen and there's a sheer joy in their playing, which I imagine translates live, which is why they're probably so popular live. You hear that. They're just having fun. Is that something that, you know, it's like, sometimes I feel like people take music and the process of it too seriously. It's supposed to be fun, you know, and that's what you hear with this band.
There is something about, like, I was thinking about our music, our AI music discussion, and the thing about music, and this actually translates to TV and movies as well, is that there is enough of it for the rest of time, considering, like, if we just stop creating it right now, when you think of every generation has had their own music, then they're simply, and everybody dies. So if you were 10 and you were introduced to music that started in 1990 and went until, you know, today, you would have enough music. Like you could be reared on the same music, but there is this desire to create, which is what the different, like, music is commerce on some level. Music is used for commerce. But if the entire commerce of music disappeared, our country, like, from an economic perspective, would be fine. It's not like a necessary export. It's not like fucking wheat or something. You know, like, we don't need to keep making it. It is the human desire to create and be influenced by something and to create that makes music and movies and all of these things different than something that is straight commerce. And hearing a band love the music that they're playing is like the essence of why this music exists.
That's a great point. That's the X factor. It's like you said, nothing more needs to be written.
No, there's more than enough. If everything stopped right now and you could only, especially with our access to all of it, which did not always exist, at this point, our access to every bit of this is fine. If it all stopped right now, you could watch a different movie and start a different TV show and listen to a different album every single day of your life that you had never consumed before and only pick the good stuff.
Right.
And you would still have enough to consume for the rest of
it. You could never get all the way through it. Maybe that's a interesting angle into the AI conversation as far as the fear over it, because maybe that's the antidote, is to recognize that the need to create is the human thing.
Right. That is what it, like, it'll never stop humans from wanting to create. The only, when you think about, like, the only reason for, and by the way, like, AI could be used within music to help people create on some level.
That's the, like, upside of it. That's some people who are proponents of it say you can almost use it as a co-writer or a collaborator in a sense.
And look, when auto-tune existed, which is a form of artificial intelligence, at least like on the timeline of it, like on the prism of it, it has not stopped good singers from thriving, and it has not stopped singers from the desire to be good just because it could. Now, could artificial intelligence help one person, one creator, one artist who does not have access to studio musicians? By the way, drum machines have existed forever. Pro Tools, which can fix notes in guitar playing, and you know, it can fix a drummer who is slightly off beat. Like, all these things have existed, but they have not stopped our desire to do these things. So I just keep coming to the end of, like, the only true purpose of AI music is if we felt like there was a void in the amount of music that we could consume, which there is not. If anything, there is more than we can consume, or from a commerce perspective. But we don't, like, need it from a commerce perspective. Like, it doesn't, and it's not, I don't think it will be good enough from a commerce perspective to exist. So I'm not worried about it in any way from a creative perspective, because the human condition is to create. And that is what is special about music.
And that's the big difference between human creation and AI.
Yes.
The AI is just synthesizing things at a rate that a human, you know, mind maybe can't, but it doesn't actually at its core have the urge that we do. That's what separates it. That's what makes it because if you think about long before there were records or before there was commerce around, people were singing, people were performing, beyond certain forms of classical music that were documented, you didn't have records out there. I mean, people went and performed, and it was something to do to connect to people. There, we had troubadours. It was about connecting the community. So it's almost a primal instinct to create sound and to want to express yourself in that way. So you're right. I hadn't thought of it that way. That is the big difference between human creators and this other thing, which is AI, which is here now. So we have to just adjust to it, but it's the big separating point, I would say.
For sure. Like, I don't want any of, like, you or any of my other, like, friends in my life whose music is their career to not have it be able to be their career. However, if it was nobody's career, I do still think people would do it. Like, I don't think it would stop the creation of music because of that feel and that need to do so.
I think for me, that's why my favorite aspect of it is the performance, because that is the human thing. In a room with people, it could be 50 people, it could be 5,000 people, it doesn't matter. You're in a room, you're making connection with people. That is the most vital part of it to me. Sometimes the writing, I can enjoy that, but that can become maddening sometimes. Writing songs, I mean, I've written a number of songs recently that just totally scrapped, you know, and that can be an infuriating process. Being in the studio can be tedious. I know some people enjoy it more than others. For me, it is the human connection of being in the room with people. And that gets to the point you're making. I mean, maybe AI can perform live at some point too, but I don't know. But it's a human connection between you singing with the audience and then giving the energy back to you, and that synthesis that happens. That also, I think, is singular. I don't know that you can fully replace that ever.
And if you can, like, I don't want to be afraid of it. Until there is a day where I would prefer to see a fake an artificially generated person on a stage to a human person, until there is a day where it is creating music on its own without human input that I like better than the music that is created by humans, I am not going to be concerned about that. Like, there are so many things about humans. Definitely want to create music more than they want to go to their, like there's something natural and about it more than going to an office for 8 hours a day.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
like,
absolutely.
And we're not worried about, like, I guess on some level we're worried about AI replacing that, but like computers and artificial intelligence have already gotten rid of, like, a ton of jobs. And I don't see, like, the people, like, crying over AI taking their jobs, which are, by the way, a lot of people are in the white collar area. I imagine drive-through easy pass, use self-checkout. There are a lot of automated things that they have done without any care in the world thinking about the jobs that they have replaced. And those are jobs that people do to like survive, but they don't fucking like them.
Right, right.
the way that they like creating music, there's no urge to go work in a fucking toll booth. Well, I'm not saying that everybody hates it or there's a bad job, but you don't like wake up in the morning and say, you know what I'd like to spend the next 10 hours doing? Sucking fucking exhaust fumes and giving people change.
Yeah, that's a tough job, man. You know, I admire anyone who can do that because that's a really hard job. You know, but with music creation too, there's this whole other element that it's just, it's therapeutic, it's cathartic. It's not, here's the thing. Yes, as a performer, you want to be in a room, you want to connect to people, you want to make fans, you want that experience, but you can also just be totally fulfilled in a sense, singing and playing for yourself.
Yes.
And if you're not in a good mood or you're sad or you're down, sometimes it's just that on that most baseline level, there's something therapeutic about it.
That 100%.
And that gets back to the same point. That's a great point. That's actually a new way of thinking about it for me. Is that that's the big dividing line there, is that the need to create that we have, that the AI is never going to have. AI isn't wired that way.
What will our point be if we do not have these things? Like, this is like our point in technology. We are solving for problems that are not problems because we have largely solved, like our need to eat, like, you know, like our, I said that the last time, like you don't see squirrels with like these existential issues because their entire, or tigers, because their entire existence is surviving to the next day. Like their goal is to get food and to get shelter and to rear their young. But like we largely have these problems solved for us. So we are left with these other challenges. Nobody is asking us to solve the problem of humans are like, there's no dread. Like, oh no, I got to create music today and I don't want to do that.
Right. To feed most the people commercial don't do machine. It. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So one other song I wanted to mention before we go, and I want to get to Frank Carter and the Rattlesnakes because I have like 10 minutes before Ricky time, is, what was I going to say? Second Best. Which is a straight-ahead Southern rock, but the band I wanted to bring up in relation to this band is 38 Special, who is not a hair band, was definitely like an 80s band that you remember. Southern rock, great hooks. I think this band is like more 38 Special than they are Skynyrd. I certainly hear like the Skynyrd stuff, but a band like 38 Special or Tesla or something like that, a band that took Southern rock elements and turned it into regular rock and roll or something is where I think this band lives.
Yeah. It's I got to see them. I don't even know if they've made it to the States yet, but if they do,
I would love
that'll have to be
too.
A Carl field trip, you know, because by all accounts, they are just, I mean, you hear it. It's strange how some bands, you can hear the studio record and be like, yeah, they're good live. You know they're good live.
There's certainly no doubt. Let's see where they're, are they?
Only EU and UK for now.
As far as
that's actually their first international tour, so. They might just be on the cusp of breaking out, you know, to a broader audience just as we speak.
Got to get them over here. Got to get them over here. Your single is Fred Carter, former Sixers head coach, and the Rattlesnakes. Carter and the Rattlesnakes.
Yes, indeed. So I give another shout out to Delia. This is another discovery from one of her playlists, just like Lil Young was. So,
yeah.
You know, some songs you hear, you live with, you hear an element or two you like, and then you live with it and it grows on you. And then there are songs like this one for me. I was immediately hooked in when I heard this song. You might listen to a playlist and that's cool, that's cool. And then, whoa, what's that? That was my experience with this tune. Frank Carter and the Rattlesnakes, just give a brief background. English punk band formed in 2015 by the frontman, Frank Carter, with the guitarist Dean Richardson, and their members are, well, it's essentially a duo, but live in the studio, they're more of a band. Frank Carter on lead vocals, Dean Richardson on guitar, synthesizer, piano, and backing vocals, and then their current touring and session musician core is Tom Barkley on bass, keyboard, synthesizer, backing vocals, Garrett Grover on drums and percussion, and Elliot Russell on guitar, keyboards, and synthesizer. Another band, just like the Southern River Band, highly acclaimed for their live performances. And from what I've read, Frank Carter, just a phenomenal front man. And you can almost, it's kind of a strange parallel. You can almost hear that when you listen to this. Sometimes, you know, some bands you can't tell, like, is this a studio project? How does this translate? And some things you hear and you're like, well, this must translate live. Maybe it's a mirage sometimes, but.
There was one thing that made me think of you when I was listening to it is like that sort of like Snake Charmery thing to the beat, which reminded me of Turkish music or sort of like you really like that stuff, you know, or have brought that stuff to me. And that part of it reminded me of you.
Well, that is a great point because that you hear that. Now I'll give two examples. When we did King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard,
yep.
Right? They go full on into that because they have the full on influence of Turkish music, Arab music, and you know, they have those Arabic sounds, those Middle Eastern sounds that you recognize, and they actually play the scales, the microtones they're playing. Here it's more implied. It's more in the because of the way the chords move, it's like a half step, and you hear his voice almost veer into that more Middle Eastern style of singing that you've heard in some of my, I have some tunes like that. And that's probably, for me, I grew up listening to that because I used to go to Turkey every summer. I just remember hearing that when I was there. So it's kind of just baked in. But here, you wouldn't necessarily, for a punk band that, you know, listen to some of their other stuff, this is kind of distinctive within what they do. And it really just, it's a big part of it. It kind of gives this almost eerie, ominous, not ominous, but eerie sort of hypnotic feeling, like you said, to the music. So they've released a number of albums, Blossom in 2015, Modern Ruin in 2017, End of Suffering in 2019. They've been prolific. Fourth album, Sticky, was released in 2021, and they just released their new record, A Dark Rainbow, last month, and this was the second single that came out in November. A band that's toured extensively. They've had some big tour looks, big festival looks. They toured as a support act for Foo Fighters in Europe in 2019.
Oh, wow.
And have had a couple tough breaks along the way. They were getting ready to do this huge festival in Croatia, the In Music Festival 2018. They had a bus crash. And then a year later, they were about to do their first North American tour, Frank Carter was in a car crash. Thankfully, they were okay and came out unscathed, but they had to cancel that whole tour. So they've had a couple difficult moments that they've been able to persevere through and keep playing, but just a really cool band. I'm just now getting into them. I started checking out some of their other work, but just to get into this tune, it's the half step. I guess it's a bass. You know, when you hear that sound, it could be a guitar, the chord line, but it sounds like a fuzz bass, like an effective bass.
I was going to say it sounded like a bass to me, too.
Yeah. And that song is that instrument is the propulsion. Frank Carter's vocal style. Now, in the verses, it's the smooth, understated thing. It's almost like a crooner style of singing, kind of. You could hear him do, you know, things in the vein of Sinatra or Nat King Cole, that kind of thing. He's in that space vocally in the verses. But then the way it builds up on the hook, and this song really showcases him as a singer. And another band that we've heard more and more of these groups, you know, I think of Marian Hill, but I think of Lola Young, some of these other songs we've discussed, artists we've discussed, the sparse approach of taking three, four, or five songs, tracks that work and leaving a lot of space in there. And that creates such a nice dynamic. And you hear that on this song. I think this is a track that just sort of is immediate, undeniable. I don't know if it's the kind of thing that'll make it on the radio here, per se. Probably not, right? But it feels like a hit in the sense of the kind of song that people are going to single out on playlists and so on.
It probably could have made it on the radio, on alternative radio, 20 years ago. It actually reminded me of, I think we talked about She Wants Revenge once, I think, when we're doing a video, a pod on videos we really liked, but there's a band called She Wants Revenge, I think still exists, but a band that was definitely from the Interpol school of sort of like weird, moody, bass-driven, almost like, you know, grew up listening to Depeche Mode sort of music.
Yes. And Depeche Mode has elements of, you hear a band like this, you hear that that there's that something sonically that reminds me of them.
Yeah, there's something and there's something off about it in like the coolest way.
Yes.
In that it isn't music. There's all these things that we hear, like I hear the Snake Charmer thing and I hear Interpol or She Wants Revenge, but like it is singular in its own existence. Like this it's weird in a cool way, and like what the fuck is this really? And then it's weird the first time you listen to it, and then you listen to it again and you sort of get the you figure out like exactly what's going on. It's very, very unique. Delia's got good weird taste. Yeah.
She her taste is all over the place. I mean, she grew up on metal and then she likes a lot of the R&B and soul stuff, but then she'll find stuff like this. So her play, I got to give her a shot because her playlists have led to a few of my single picks over time.
I think she's probably got better playlists than Daryl Morey does, which is full of fucking.
That was just the 40 music. Hours of musicals, right?
Yeah, I'm sure he's added to it too. I want to
maybe
go
it's
back
up to 60 hours. Should we have him back on when he gets to 100 hours? Maybe.
I'm trying to think whether Daryl's welcome back on the Carl again. I think we could have him again. We could definitely have him.
That was fun. That was just something totally out of left field.
Yep,
it's funny to have a guy like Daryl Morey on and do what we did, which is just mainly talk about musicals.
Yes.
We're the only podcast that could have a high profile executive on in the sports world, and we would talk to that person about musicals.
About their one Spotify playlist that is largely musical.
That has like 100 Sondheim songs on it.
Yeah. Weirdo. All right. If you would like to suggest an album, do it. As I mentioned before, you could just go to CarlLandryRecordClub.com and we look forward to it. Otherwise, we will talk to you next time.
Stay free, my goose.